Welcome to the Digital Analytics Power Hour. Tim, Michael, Mo, and the occasional guest discussing digital analytics issues of the day. Find them on Facebook at facebook.com/analyticshour and their website analyticshour.io. And now, the Digital Analytics Power Hour.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Digital Analytics Power Hour. This is episode 84. On a scale of 0 to 1, would you consider yourself a Bayesian statistician? So much of what we do as analysts doesn't really resolve itself into clear-cut answers to questions. And frankly, I'm unsure of all we're going to even get into today on the podcast. But my clear recommendation is to stay tuned because something in here is going to be useful. Well, let's start with what we know for sure. That is my two co-hosts, Mo Kiss, Analytics Manager at The Iconic. Hi, Mo.
Hey, how's it going?
It's going good. Thanks for Americanizing your game on my behalf.
You're welcome.
And Tim Wilson, Senior Director of Analytics at Search Discovery. Hello, Tim.
How are you feeling, Michael?
Oh, that's such a great question. I'm going to hold off on answering that because this will go in a whole different direction. And I am Michael Helbling. I lead the analytics practice here at Search Discovery. But enough with the known. We needed a guest who could help us unify all the statistical thinking that we're getting into these days into useful applications. Dr. Ellen McDonald-Fite is a Bayesian statistician. She is the assistant professor of marketing at Drexel University, a senior fellow at the Wharton Customer Analytics Initiative, and recently wrote the book R for Marketing Research and Analytics. And now I am reasonably certain she is a guest on our show. Welcome to the show, Ellie.
I am so excited to be here. Thanks for having me.
Oh, we're excited. I think this has been a long time coming, so we're pretty stoked to have you on the show.
I mean, the first choice was Thomas Bayes, but we found out that he was not available.
He's all dead.
He passed, unfortunately. Yeah. Hashtag too soon, Tim. So to get us kind of started, there's so many directions we're going to go, but I want to maybe start with just understanding what you do today. You're a professor, so you're teaching students, you're teaching classes. Let's start with that, just some background information on the kinds of things you're doing in your day-to-day.
Yeah, so I've been at Drexel for 4 years now, and when I got to Drexel, my big goal was to kind of infuse digital into the marketing curriculum. So I teach an undergrad class called Data-Driven Digital Marketing, and I like to say it's a spoonful of digital marketing sugar to help the analytics medicine go down. The students think they're coming into class to learn how to do marketing on like Snapchat or whatever the latest social media platform is that they're really excited about. And I'm like, but we're going to look at the data behind it. And, that gives me a chance to sort of teach them a little bit about data analysis in a context that they really, you know, really like.
That's awesome.
So we go, there's all kinds of stuff. So they actually, as kind of a centerpiece of the class, they have to do some sort of digital marketing campaign on behalf of a small client in the Philadelphia area where we are. So that could be improving a website through an A-B test. That could be running an email A-B test. That could be buying ads on Facebook and trying to figure out if those ads have positive ROI. You know, any number of those things.
Do they ever?
Sorry.
Sorry, yes. Trigger.
Sometimes.
There was no trigger warning there.
Sometimes, not all the time. Actually, it's fun to watch them actually run through the numbers and get to the negative ROI and think, oh crap, all my marketing dreams are not true. And
that might be the best thing you could be doing for the next generation of marketers and analytics people. Is letting them see that right away and early.
Well, and with money that they spent themselves on an ad campaign that they were dreaming about would be perfect. And, you know, when we teach intro marketing, people, it's just a field of dreams. It's only the sort of Don Draper Mad Men pitch meeting part. And we never get into the, I actually ran the campaign. I had a whole bunch of problems when I was getting the whole thing set up. I couldn't figure out, you know, how to set up the targeting in Facebook. I have students who've been in like two or three marketing classes that discussed targeting and didn't really get it until we're in the back end of Facebook picking the targeting for their ad. I'm like, these are the people who are going to see your ad. That's targeting. So
maybe that's what Facebook's going to claim is going to see your ad. Yeah. Well, and if it doesn't work, okay. Do you teach them to actually double down on what they're spending?
They're beginners, right? We have to give them some training wheels. Okay. I really enjoy that group. I love the sort of math phobic students that you often get. So I get marketing majors and I'm trying to give them a little bit of this analytics, and sometimes they're really nervous about it. But when you can kind of rebuild people's confidence, you know, maybe they've had a bad math teacher in high school or something that really knocked them down a few pegs. And if you can build them back up, they can actually be really good at that stuff. So that's my undergrad class. The other class is a full semester class in marketing experiments. So A/B testing, multivariate testing. It mostly attracts students who are attending to be data scientists who maybe don't have a lot of marketing exposure and know a lot of machine learning methods. And I like to say I beat them with a causality stick for 10 weeks to help them really understand the value of randomization in figuring out how business decisions are going to affect outcomes. So that's the other class. Covers all of that stuff from both a Bayesian and a classical perspective. So one of the things I was really excited to talk to you guys about since I was coming here today is what should be in my courses for students? What should be future, what do the current digital analytics professionals think that future digital analytics professionals should be learning in college?
I actually was about to ask you a question about whether we should all be going back to university to do your course, because as you're talking through some of this stuff, I can't help but think, I mean, so many of us in the industry never had an education like that. We never learned the stats behind an A/B test. We just started doing it and trying to figure it out along the way, which is super dangerous. So yeah, from my perspective, all I hear when I'm listening to you talk about this courses is like, how do I sign up?
I'm sure the admissions office at Drexel would be happy to talk to you. We have a large number of international students who pay a lot of tuition to come to Drexel.
I almost feel like academia is doing a better job of trying to ask the question of what's needed, and they're turning to, in many ways, a group of people who are ill-equipped to answer, kind of to Mo's point, that there's a level of, I don't know whether it's sticking our heads in the sand or whether it's because we haven't really figured it out. Like if you take you're teaching an accounting course and you're asking people who've been in the accounting profession for 5 years or 10 years or 20 years, what do they really need to know? And their things will change and they will evolve, but you've got the people who've really figured it out who are tenured at companies, and this is how we're doing accounting. I feel like there's still a ton of companies that are still plodding along without that appropriate background. In some ways, education by vendor, which is increasingly terrifying, I'm realizing. I mean, ask one of our favorite guests his opinion of one of the more predominant A/B testing platforms, and you'll get a hell of an earful on that. And so it's kind of this ugly cycle where we've sort of been taught bad habits or shortcuts that are really, really scary. And I've had it explained to me multiple times. I've gone through courses. I've read The Signal and the Noise. Is that the name of Nate Silver's book? And I'm like, I don't intuitively get Bayesian versus frequentism. I've read a definition. Like, are you undergrad or graduate able to really articulate what Bayesian statistics is and why that mindset or why that approach or way of thinking actually brings value from an embracing of uncertainty, or however it brings value? I don't know if that's 17 questions plus a diatribe.
So am I able to articulate to undergraduate or graduate students why I'm a Bayesian? That's like asking someone why they're Catholic, right? It's a deeply held belief about how we should think about uncertainty.
Well, but Catholicism, right? You could define what that doctrine is. So I guess it's more like what I sort of feel like if you can articulate what a Bayesian mindset is or what then it shouldn't become evident.
I don't know that I'm so. Yeah. So one of the things you should be aware
we've got 6 hours. I know, so if you need to pull out the whiteboard, we're good to go.
So this is always a tough question, but the main thing that Bayesians do is that, to some extent, all properly trained statisticians are obsessed with uncertainty. We want to not just know that we have uncertainty, but we want to measure as precisely as we can how much uncertainty we actually have. And the Bayesian approach has proven to be really useful in settings like, well, one of the first settings was in figuring out where to aim a cannon or other ballistic thing to get the maximum effect against your enemy. When you don't know a lot of things like the wind and other things that might affect exactly where this ballistic thing is going to land. And so this Bayesian approach to looking at that as a decision problem. So Bayesians are focused on how do we make decisions under uncertainty like this? Whereas I don't think classical statisticians are as focused on decisions, and they also have a different approach. So I think every quantity that is out in the world that exists, I think of as having a probability distribution. Like everything has some uncertainty, and I'm just obsessed with like knowing how much uncertainty that is. So I would never say something like next week on Tuesday, we'll have 50,239 visitors to our website. I would always give you a range for that because am I making any sense?
Well, yeah, but you would say next week, I would expect 95% of the time. Well, I'm even trying to articulate a confidence level.
I might say exactly that. I might say, so, and that's the one thing. So classical statisticians, because of the way they think about uncertainty, they characterize uncertainty as what would happen if I replicated this process over and over. And so they say these really backward sounding sentences, but Bayesians are just straightforward about it. They say, I believe that with 95% probability, the website traffic on Tuesday will be between 30,000 and 50,000 users. And on top of that, you should make a decision. Like say, if you're trying to size, you should size for 50,000 people, or maybe you should size for 60,000 people, because if the website goes down and crashes, that would be really, really bad.
I was about to ask, because as you're talking through your obsession with uncertainty, which I find super fascinating, how that plays out in a business context, because often decision makers, I don't know, I guess in a footnote somewhere, they want to hear about uncertainty. But when it comes to your recommendation, they just want to, hey, you should size your website for 60,000 visitors or whatever the decision mm-hmm. is. And so I really like how you just framed that of, I'm still going to give you the range, but then I'm going to tell you this is the action that you should take based on the upper limits of that range. Is
right.
that,
that's
a, I mean, is that how you would position it to the business?
Yes, that's exactly how I try to position things to when I'm talking to decision makers. So just because I have uncertainty doesn't mean I'm not sure about what to do. Does that make sense? Just because I'm not sure about a particular quantity in the world, I'm not sure how many people are going to show up on Tuesday next week. That doesn't mean I can't decide what to do, especially if I can quantify that uncertainty and kind of give it a range, then I actually am more powerful because I can say this is likely to take this much web capacity. Another great example I heard from a guy who was an analytics professional at Best Buy, and he worked with Geek Squad, and Geek Squad was always reporting the meat to their customers. A customer walks in, says, I want to get my computer fixed. The part's on back order. So they would quote the mean time that they expect to take to repair the computer. And of course, that means that more than like half of the customers, because half of the time it's over the mean.
Well, now, wait a minute. Are we confusing mean and median? Because that's actually something I do understand.
I'm not certain.
Okay. So yeah, I was being sloppy about mean versus median there. You caught me. For a lot of distributions, they're close to each other, but you get the point. There were plenty of people who were not getting the average amount of time. And so they just changed to reporting the 95% longest time. They rank the times in the past by how long it's taken and try to hit the 95% on that. And that's what they quote the customer. which means it's probably going to be less than that for most people, which is what people want. They want to hear that their computer came back faster than was expected.
But back to your traffic forecasting, you're actually, yeah. If you are, as opposed to saying you should be planning for 60,000, if you're thinking in uncertainty and you're saying, I think it's going to be this range, then the discussion becomes, how comfortable are you taking a risk that we crash the site? Because it may be pretty damn cheap to be 80% of the time you're going to be fine. And it may get really expensive to say, no, I want to be 99% of the time. And therefore being able to think about that spread.
Yeah. And Bayesians actually have a name for that. They call it the loss. So the loss, if I make a decision and it turns out the truth is something different than what I, you know, what I was expecting or what I just planned for, what's the loss? So in that case, it's a case of what we call asymmetric loss. So if I oversize, I waste a little bit of money because I had more web service available than I really needed. But on the other hand, if I crash the website, I lose a lot more. And that is what we call asymmetric loss. So yeah, we're really thinking about not only our uncertainty about quantities, but also what should we do in the face of that uncertainty, which of course is a function of how much we'll lose if we make the wrong decision.
So there's a point where I feel like we wind up in forecasting land, which is an analyst. I've never been asked to predict traffic or revenue. And that's partly me. Plenty of people, especially in retail, especially of holiday, are like, look, we need to predict demand. I've found myself sometimes using forecasting as a way to look for anomalies, saying, how did my actual results compare to a forecast if those didn't exist? What are the other, I'm trying to think through, what are the ways that thinking of uncertainty, when we're doing historical data analysis, and it may be that I'm completely framing it wrong, looking at past behavior on the site. I want to find the most common paths. I want to find fallout points. I want to optimize my site in the absence of an A/B test. I'm trying to wrap my head around where the uncertainty mindset, I'm really liking thinking of Bayesian as embracing uncertainty because I'm getting way, way better about understanding uncertainty. So that's actually mm-hmm. closing that gap. I don't know. Is that a fair question?
Yeah. So the way I think of it is that the numbers from the past are what they are. And they have no uncertainty. We know, well, there might be a little bit of measurement uncertainty, like, you know, maybe the tracking system went down or something happened. But for the most part, you know, when we're looking in, say, Google Analytics and we're saying how many people came to the site and which sources of traffic converted at the highest rate, I don't feel like we have to say a whole lot about the uncertainty on those. And so in kind of this what I call sort of historical slicing and dicing framework that most web analytics professionals spend most of their time doing, the uncertainty doesn't really matter. If you're just saying this is how many people came last Tuesday, it's just a fact, right? And it doesn't have uncertainty.
Because I used to think that's the challenge when statisticians work with samples and we're saying we have all the historical data, we have the population. But the little light bulb that's gone on for me is that if I'm looking at comparisons between, and the simple one is between my traffic sources. And mm-hmm. I want to look at that and say, yes, I can say that paid search drove more traffic than organic search, but there's value in trying to look at that and saying, what is the variability and how much traffic came from paid search versus organic search? Are they really different? Or yes, the absolute population is different, but are those channels really different?
What I was about to say is that when we're looking at historical data, we're implicitly asking questions about the future.
Okay.
So when I look at my conversion rate by different source of traffic, I'm implicitly looking for a difference that I believe will be true in the future so that I can act on it. So I find out that paid search is delivering high conversion rate on particular keywords. Let's buy more of those keywords, right? So there's an implicit prediction about the future in there. And if we adopt more statistical techniques, we can be more explicit about that prediction and more clear about what our uncertainty is about that future prediction. And what we're doing is we're saying, well, I expect the future to be like the past. So, and actually then quantifying uncertainty with data often means looking at how much data do I actually have here And is it enough to say that there's a real difference? Or is there a possibility that I would have seen, you know, this big of a difference between two sources just by random chance, even if they were truly the same? So that's the core thing that we're, you know, that's why we do confidence intervals, is to figure out, do we have enough data to come to a conclusion that if these things kind of have a true long run mean, is it different or not?
Can I just ask, and this is my own personal mullings of the last recent little while, which I haven't figured out remotely.
You mean like the last 5 minutes or the last like 3 months?
No, like last 3 months. Okay. God, Tim, I'm a deep, thoughtful person.
I've got some uncertainty about what you mean by that phrase.
This is getting like way too deep for me.
Don't worry. I have a question that'll bring us right back to the surface after now.
Yeah, I want to come up. I want to come up for air, please.
Okay, so bringing it back, you had a statement that I'm interested in hearing your perspective on a little bit further, because like I said, I haven't figured out my thoughts on this yet, which is that past behavior and past data is acceptable to help us predict what's going to happen in the future. And I'm just going to do a dot, dot, dot and leave it open for you to comment on.
So yeah, I think it's important, like really good statisticians are very explicit about what they expect is going to be stable in the future. So that's part of when I make a statement as a Bayesian statistician that says, I believe that the traffic on next Tuesday is going to be between 30,000 and 50,000 users with 95% probability. Embedded in that analysis are some clear assumptions about whether next Tuesday is going to be like last Tuesday, usually in some very specific way. Like I have, so Bayesians usually build a model for that, which is just our way of saying that we have an equation that describes what we think Tuesday is going to be like as a function of what day of the week it was and any special holidays. And that model is part of my assumptions baked into it. So I actually like the process of building that model because it makes me lay bare and explicit how I think the future is related to the past. But yeah, everything I say when I make that probability statement kind of has that, my assumptions baked into it. And you could examine my assumptions and say, I don't agree. Mm-hmm. I don't think Tuesday, all Tuesdays are alike, or whatever it is about my equation. By writing it out like as an equation, then you can see it and say, I don't agree, or I do agree, or that seems pretty reasonable. So that's kind of part of the modeling process. I really like to say that I model professionally.
Nice. So good.
It's a great line in a bar, you know? And our listeners can't see us, but I'm like a middle-aged kind of ordinary looking woman. So definitely don't model clothing professionally. I model data professionally.
That's awesome.
So I don't know. I mean, yeah, I think it's better to be explicit than implicit about, you know, why would we look at the data on what happened to our website in the past if we didn't think it had something to do with the future, right? Like, we don't even need to look at it because we're making decisions about now and in the future. We're not making decisions about the past. So we don't really care about the past at all, except that it can drive our future perspective. And maybe one way we could kind of come back up to the surface on this is like to talk a little bit about how digital analysts have been trained to look at the past. Like that's the main thing that the tools teach you how to do. They don't teach you to think about the future very much. I mean, look at the user interface for Google Analytics. What's the first thing you see? You see a time series plot of the traffic to the website over the last, what is it, 30 days or something?
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
There's not even like a little dotted line making you think about the future. It's just, here it is. This is what happened last month. And so I think, you know, we might be training people to think about just cataloging and reporting on the history. And I like to call that a data retriever. Analysts who all they can do is find out answers about what happened in the past.
What breed of animals do you have? Oh, we have retrievers. That's right. It's one of the most popular types of animals.
So one thing that's inherent in being able to have a more forward-looking view is bringing together all of the assumptions and things that will impact your model or your prediction. right? And so one of the big challenges I've found for analysts is just building their library of possible things that could make a difference. Hmm. How do you teach students or talk to people about how to develop sort of that? I don't know if it's a set of experiences, skill set. You know, some of it's in the data, but some of it's not. Some of it's experience. So how would you approach that?
I actually think the digital analytics community might be better at building that library than, say, the data science community. So let me just complain about my data science students, my future data scientists. They're really well trained to take any data set and build a predictive model off of it. So they get, you know, some data set on whether or not people converted with all their behaviors at the website. And then they know all these fancy machine learning methods that basically sort through all those variables to try to find the ones that are most closely related to the conversion. But I think that's where kind of domain knowledge and just being a good marketer can come in. If you can just sit back with that before you look at the data and start thinking about, like, okay, what do I think is affecting conversion? Well, maybe there's certain pages that I think that if you looked at, you'd be more likely to convert because those pages describe product benefits that I think would convince people. Or maybe if you came in through a certain channel, like a blog post, you were already so deeply engaged in the product and the blog post probably said something good about the product, like you're more likely to convert. So in a lot of ways, the data scientists are just like, it's all data. We'll just let the computer sort it out. But I think that digital analysts have a lot to bring to the table in terms of intuition about, you know, just good marketing know-how about what is likely to affect outcomes. And just having looked at a lot of data, what is likely to affect outcomes. So
I think that's another way that the tools have really taken a big chunk out of critical thinking from analysts is actually not treating everything as equal, as opposed to putting the hat on of, my bias is towards finding things that I can impact that actually matter. And there's a bunch of stuff I can't impact. I can't impact what my competitor's doing. When we put direct traffic next to paid search, next to organic search. And again, that's like the easy one to fall back on. Sure, you know, just run it through a model. And the solution is to drive more direct traffic on desktop. Well, good luck.
Or send more people through blog posts. Like how are you possibly going to do that? Like if it's send more people through search, you know, through paid search, I can maybe affect that a little bit. The other let's loop back to input. But if we go back, the first thing are these things likely to be associated with conversion? So let's take conversion. Yeah. Have you ever opened the GA interface for the first time and shown it to a completely green person?
I'm doing that today, so give me some tips.
It's not going to be fun. It's going to be overwhelming.
Have you looked at that menu on the left-hand side? And I don't mean to pick on GA. I use GA because they actually have a very nice... they have a website where they make the GA for a website that they run available for students. So I use GA and Adobe just...
Not the API.
But
if this podcast has any sway, we now can say that we've put in the plug for them to open up the reporting API for the store.
Oh my God, that would be awesome. Oh my God.
Look at that, Google, you're punishing academia. You're punishing this... the analysts of tomorrow, because you're not giving API access to the store.
Yeah,
data.
My data science students would love that. My marketing students, the undergrads, would probably not like that. They're going to be still looking at GA, but getting back to where I was going with this, that left-hand side menu is overwhelming, right?
Yeah.
Like there's, so I'm looking at, say I'm looking at conversion.
Have you ever opened up the Adobe Analytics?
I was going to say, you ain't seen nothing yet.
And like you said, there nothing is elevated to be more important than anything else. It's just, we can slice your conversions by these 20 different ways. And a beginner student is like, well, which way should, there's 20 different ways. Am I supposed to look at all 20? Like, don't you think we could... I think you, Michael, you could sort those items. Like, what's your number one thing that is related to conversion? Not whether we can have impact. That's another issue. What's the number one thing that's related to conversion in this kind of data?
What, in GA? Oh, geez.
I mean, what kind of behavior that's available in GA is most closely relate. If you were looking for something that was related to conversion, where would you look first?
Or second? You are being graded. You are being graded.
Yeah, I know. I'm feeling an intense amount of pressure right now. I mean, obviously, like, the stupidest answer is, do they add something to the cart or start the checkout process?
Okay.
That one.
Fair enough.
Or have they purchased previously?
Well, but is that readily available by Google data?
Might be.
Not really.
Maybe.
Not in any useful way, not without a lot of work. But like,
I don't like tests.
No.
Maybe I shouldn't go back to school.
But I guess my point is that you have some ideas.
Yeah. And in my life as an analyst,
for beginners,
I have a list of things. Yep.
Right. Which is the beginning of building a predictive model. You have an intuition.
Yeah.
You kind of know what things are important. So the next big thing that Tim brought up before is whether or not we can actually influence those things. So if you want to predict something, there's actually two kinds of predictive models. So one kind of predictive model is called an umbrella model. And that's like, say you want to predict the rain. The reason you want to predict the rain is you want to know whether or not to take an umbrella out. So you don't really care why it's raining. You just want to know if it's going to rain. And in that case, like, knowing that carting or past purchases are related to future purchases can help you make a really good prediction about like revenue next month, which could be useful, right? Like, boss probably wants to know what revenue next month is going to look like. The other type of model that Tim is probably more interested in is what I kind of call a rain dance model. So a rain dance model is, I want to know, if I dance, will it rain? If I put these extra video features on my website, will I get higher conversions? If I send out an email blast, will I get higher conversions? Those are rain dance problems. Those are ideas I have for how I'm going to make it rain. Those kinds of models take kind of more work. Someone with 18 months of data science training can't build those kind of models. You have to be more thoughtful.
Is there a point if you don't really, actually just thinking through it that way and saying, if I'm asking this question and I can give the answer, you know, if I can build this model before you even try to build the model, figure out if you're building an umbrella or a rain dance model. I mean, I feel like that's a little bit of a challenge saying, hey, we have perfectly explained everything that happens and there's nothing we can do with it. We might have invested an enormous amount in it, as opposed to the flip side of saying, you know, I can impact where my paid advertising is sending people to land on the site. If I can build a model that shows there's some predictive capability of where I send them and where they land and what the impact is, then I've built a rain dance model.
That is a rain dance model. Figuring out where the right landing page would be a rain dance kind of model.
I think that's your new nickname, Tim. You're Tim Rain Dance Wilson.
This show is actually trucking along in a beautiful direction, which doesn't happen to us all the time. So I'm just going to veer straight off the road and go in a totally different direction. As you've been talking through some of these concepts, one thing that's kind of sticking in my mind, and it's probably because I have a personal stake in this topic, is what are you teaching your students, or how are you teaching your students about their biases when they approach problems? Because I'm thinking, even of that rain dance model you just suggested, I mean, if you go in there being like, you know, if I dance harder, will it rain more? You could be starting off from that assumption that dancing leads to rain. And so I'm just curious to hear, like, is there any, because you did earlier mention feedback about what we should be teaching students. Is there anything about teaching students about biases, and particularly something like confirmation bias in analysis?
I don't do this with the undergrads, but with the grad students, by the end of class, I say it with me. Randomization will set you free. So what do I mean by that? They know that. They leave the class and they know that randomization is really important. Some of them don't actually know what randomization is, but they know it's really important. And what I mean by randomization is, if you have a true rain dance problem, you want to know if I dance, will it make it rain? Then what you really should do is take half of the places in the world and do the rain dance, and take another half of the places in the world and don't do the rain dance. Or maybe it's days. You can do days, you can do places, you can do people, do a rain dance for some people, but not for other people. and compare those two groups, that is the sort of gold standard for proving that the rain dance works. And that's what we call an A-B test, right?
Well, or even longitudinally, right? I had a case where I was asked, what's the best time for this brand to post on Facebook? And so I said, I can do that historical analysis. And they posted at 10 a.m. every Monday, Wednesday, Friday. That was my data. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, well, you have not given me, you're going to have to mix it up. I'm going to have to do some sort of longitudinal randomization. Mm-hmm. I think those words can go together.
Yes, that
in order to figure out.
I like that.
And oh, by the way, I'm changing the content. I'm changing the calls to action. I'm changing the type of post. So, it turns out I can't answer when you've been doing one thing just in, you know, you're dancing on Tuesdays in Sour Lake, Texas, and seeing if it rains, like that's not going to tell you whether dancing causes rain. Right?
Yes, that is absolutely right. So, yes, if you look at historical data, there's two problems that can happen. One is the one you mentioned where I always do the same damn thing. So how do I know what would happen if I did something different? I work with a company that sends catalogs every month on the first Monday or Tuesday, except June. And they've done this for years. So I can't tell you what would happen if you doubled up on catalogs in December because they've never done it. So that's one problem. And statisticians would call that lack of variation in the data. So there's just not enough variation in the data for me to figure out what's going on. The other problem is, and it's more evil, the evil decision makers of the past could have always been doing the dance when they know it's going to rain.
Oh.
You've never looked at data like that. Do you want to know the technical word for that?
Oh, yes.
It's called endogeneity. I hate that word. But the idea is if I'm looking at historical data, where decision makers in the past have been acting in a smart way. And the classic is advertising, right? If I'm trying to figure out if my ads work or have positive ROI, and I look at historical data, there's probably a heavy up of advertising in holiday. Almost everybody does it. So it's going to look like advertising makes sales because every time we advertise, the sales go up. But it's really the going up of the sales that is causing the advertising. And not the other way around. So that's a really kind of important concept, and randomization breaks it. You know, randomization breaks that problem. I say, no, a decision maker didn't decide to do the dance. I actually decided, you know, I had the computer randomly decide who was going to see it. And that's the core thing that gets me excited about A-B testing is it's like, I can know for sure from the A-B test that A is better than B.
Is it fair to say that design of experiments is kind of a superset of A-B testing, that you can design experiments that give you what you need that aren't necessarily an A-B test?
Oh, yeah, for sure. In fact, I'm not even sure what A-B test means. What does A-B test mean? This is actually important because I'm writing a paper about A-B testing.
Well, so the A is usually your control. No.
Yeah.
I'm curious. What does an A-B test mean to you? Like, Mo, I'm cold calling.
That's okay. As long as it's not me.
Oh, man.
Yeah, no.
Good. Put her on the hot seat.
What?
Okay. No.
Put her on the hot seat.
Fine.
Answer a question.
Yeah. If I totally faff this up, I want no judgment. Please be kind, listeners. Fine.
Please just answer the question.
Yeah, you have group A, which is your control, and they're exposed to one variant of whatever it is that you're exposing them to. And then you have group B, who are your variant, who see something different or exposed to a different feature, page, whatever it is that you're testing. So that's in really high-level layman's terms so that I don't get judged if I faff it up.
So if I do an ad where the control is I don't send an email and the treatment is I do send an email – is that an A-B test?
Yeah, absolutely.
I don't think that's a fair comparison.
As long as it's random and as long as you have a metric you can effectively test or measure between them.
Yeah. So I was just curious what you guys thought, because sometimes when I say A-B test, people do think like Mo did and say, A, it has to be something versus something else. And some people specifically call what I described a holdout test.
Oh, yeah.
I was thinking holdout.
Now I have a term to explain that. Nice.
Yeah, I don't know. I think we should define this. And we're the Digital Analytics Power Hour. I hope I can include myself in the Digital Analytics Power Hour family now. But can the Digital Analytics Power Hour say we are going to universally call A-B tests things that compare two active marketing treatments, and randomized holdouts are things that compare an active marketing treatment to something that's not? Like to nothing.
Yeah.
I don't know.
It is not the function of the Digital Analytics Power Hour to create industry standards or... we would leave that in the hands of the Digital Analytics Association or other...
So the kind of beginner version of this issue, and it's just a problem that I, a personal problem I have when I'm writing up this paper, is so I'm working on a paper where we actually look at A-B testing from a decision theoretic point of view rather than a statistical point of view. And so we look at it as I have to make a decision. And if I'm doing a test between two versions of a website, say two versions of a homepage, and I have to make a decision and I have some data and my data is not clear. So this is one of the questions I wanted to ask you. So say I do an A-B test and I do A versus B and it turns out that A and B perform about the same and it's a homepage. What should I do?
Yeah, Tim, what should she do?
First off, I'm glad we're back on a test, because I feel like the direct marketing and the email marketing winds up being, in a sense, there's an easier component to that. And that's where holdouts come in, because I don't think you don't have a holdout scenario when you're doing an A-B test on a site and the vendors have conditioned us to talk about web experiences for A-B. And I think that's why that's a piece there. I think that it would be helpful for us to accept that many tests, because in practice, many tests don't turn out a winner. Winner is a binary term. I think that's problematic. That's where all this uncertainty kind of comes in as well. People love to talk about the, you know, how you see a big winner and then the test effect deteriorates over time or whatever that is.
Oh, I don't know about that. Explain that to me.
Well, it's basically like you do an A-B test, and I'll post at least one article because they're all over the place, and say, oh, this had a 5% lift and it was statistically significant. And so then, you run the same test again. I'm going to butcher what this is. It's kind of like doing an AA test that shows significance when it's an AA test. That being another.
Well, that happens. You know, significance happens.
Yes. Yeah.
5% of the time at random.
Yes.
When it truly wasn't significant.
But the other is that when, so an A-B test where you say, oh, this one shows a certain lift. We were getting this result, this change. So just other result, we shift to using our B variation. And then over time, it winds up back exactly where it started and trying to explain why that happened. And people seem to write about that fairly often, but not the people who are selling that as a service or a solution. I mean, because I think that's, if you take the data scientists and if you throw a bandit into it and say, you know what, we're not going to turn this stuff off. We're going to let it keep running, because even if it's down to 5%, we kind of want to be able to renormalize to whatever seems to be working better. Keep running. As opposed to saying, I'm going to run this test. I'm going to get an absolute truth, which there is no truth. I'm going to switch to that truth and then move forward. That's what we have freaking taught all marketers and analysts to do. That was like six tirades. And maybe I just dodged the question. I got partial credit.
Yeah, I was like, I'm not sure you answered the question there, Tim.
Did I get partial credit though for just
I don't even remember the question anymore. So
yeah,
look at that.
All I know is Tim was like,
this is how I got through college.
There's no such thing as truth. And it's sort of like, well, then why answer the question at all?
No, there is no truth, right? I mean, that's
tell that to the Catholics, Tim.
Tim for politician.
The fact is, you almost, like, I've gotten to where I rattle off Matt Gershoff that we're operating under conditions of uncertainty. There's a cost to reducing uncertainty, and we can't eliminate uncertainty. And you, like, Ellie, you almost quoted, like, you said that first part, and Matt wouldn't take credit for being the one who coined that. It's just, it finally sunk in with me that
it's just that we're both Bayesians, right? So we say the same thing. The same, we learned the same catechism from the Reverend Thomas Bayes, right?
So. Yeah, I have no idea what the question was.
I think she asked you what you would do if you didn't find statistical significance in an A-B test on the home page if they were the same.
Oh, yeah. No, if they were the same.
Yeah.
Yeah, what it's not statistically different.
I would dig in a little bit, but then I'd be okay. If I was testing a fucking button color and there was no difference, I'd be like, I'd probably be going back and saying, yeah, you know what? Deep orange versus deep blue, it doesn't fucking matter. Like, so that'd be applying some level of, I'm doing this test because it's not a significant in marketing strategic terms test, but I was conditioned that I could change the button color or the button text. If it was, wow, these are fundamentally different. Wait, maybe if I dig in a little bit more, peel the onion back, and this is, we were having the Simpsons paradox discussion before we started. Maybe it's because I've lumped too much stuff together. So there's some level of digging in. There's some level of applying some subject matter expertise and moving on.
Yeah. And it depends on what levers you're able to pull, back to your point about what can I and can I actually do in business practice. So say it's the homepage. The button on the homepage has to be the same for everybody. So it really doesn't matter if there's subgroups that are more affected by blue than orange than other people. I just need to pick one. And actually at that point, a Bayesian say, I don't care. Just pick one. Whatever you want. You know, that is the perfect time to let the most important person in the room decide, right? Who cares? It doesn't matter. It doesn't affect the business outcome. But we should just pick one and move on. A lot of statisticians would say, collect more data. That's ridiculous.
Just run the test until you get significance. Is that not a good idea? You don't just run the test until it bubbles to significance?
Because all of this is just going right over.
I'm learning like gazillions in this episode. So can we just focus on me for a moment?
Sure. It's beautiful. I know. I feel like this, I have so much lighter content to share with you guys. How did we get so deep?
So, okay, I have a question and I'd like to hear how you'd approach this problem. So we're definitely not experts in A-B testing. It's kind of in its infancy where I work. And one of the problems we're having in my particular team is that we always come back to measuring success of an A-B test by a reduction in a particular category of customer service contacts. Okay. Now, the problem is even if we have like 10,000 people in the control and 10,000 people in the variant, the percentage of those who contact customer service for a very specific reason is so small that I'm hesitant to make any decisions on it. What would you do? Because I've got no idea at the moment.
So that's actually like a really important and practical problem in marketing that I don't think statistics is tackling as well as the statisticians are just not providing solutions, because statisticians are used to measuring things like the length of your foot, which is normally distributed across the population. Whereas you're talking about a low frequency event, a particular type of customer service contact. And as those events become very low frequency, what happens is the required sample size just explode. Like they could be in the millions, or it depends on how low the probability is. Like if it's 1 in 1,000 or, you know, if it's 1 in 1,000, in 10,000, you might see 10, right? So
that's about what I'm looking at.
I'll cut this out if I fail the course at this point. But does a t-test not take into account the size of both the successful versus?
So for conversions, you should be using a prop test instead of a t-test. But it's close. It's very closely related. But what happens is the variance gets very large when that happens. So when the variance is large, it pushes the sample sizes up. So when there's a lot of noise in the data. So the t-test, there's several ways to think of the t-test, but I'm going to describe it in sort of a Bayesian interpretation of it. And then I'm just apologizing if there's any real statisticians listening and they don't like the way I'm describing it. I'm describing it in a Bayesian way.
We lost them a long time ago. That we lost them by like episode 3.
But the t-test is telling you, is there a high likelihood that the true average of these things is different? Or in a prop test, it's the true proportion of people who call customer service. Is it different between the A and the B? And that is a function of the variation in the data. So these low probability events drive a lot of variation in the data. And the difference, between the two things. So the bigger the difference is, the more certain we can be that there's a real difference between the things. If the two, you know, if one causes half the people to call customer service and the other one is running 1 in 1,000, we're not going to need a lot of sample to figure that out. So when you're looking for like kind of minute changes in the website that probably aren't going to change that customer service contact much, and it doesn't happen very often, you're going to need massive, massive sample sizes to detect it. And that's been a big kind of big issue in the academic literature lately. So some guys published a paper a few years ago where they were looking at display ads on Yahoo. These were display ads shown on the Yahoo homepage. Do you remember Yahoo had a homepage? And they had low probability of clicking or converting in response to that ad. And the whole point of the paper is saying, oh my God, the sample sizes here are in the millions. There's probably not enough data in the world for advertisers to figure out whether or not their advertisements are working if what they're looking for are these kind of low probability events. And there's kind of no way around it. I guess what I would suggest to you, Mo, is think about, are there any proxies that you could use that are further up in the funnel that would be related to those customer service contacts that might give you a read because they're not so low probability? Like, is there maybe looking at the page where you get the contact information for that service event, and more people are going to do that than actually call? And I mean, I get you that that's probably what the business cares about because that's expensive. So they're trying to get those down. But is there some kind of upstream measure you can use where you can get statistical significance, even if you can't get significance on those actual customer service contacts? Does that make sense?
That does. And I mean, that's kind of how I'd been thinking, but to be honest, the way you framed it is super helpful. I really, really appreciate it.
I think more importantly, I'm on the Yahoo homepage and I'm not finding any display advertising.
Apparently there was at one point.
I'm sure there was. I think that something may have come out of that study that they were like, yeah, nobody's going to pay for this. So.
The actual punchline of the paper was no one knows whether they should pay for this or not, because in order to figure out, so they were comparing ads for like the product to public service announcements. That was their A/B test. But they were figured out that the sample sizes that they would need are so enormous that they would never be able to figure out whether ads are better than public service announcements. So, and that's a pretty big punchline, right? Like, nobody has enough of an advertising budget to buy enough advertising to figure out if it works. That's not true for all channels, by the way. Direct mail is actually extremely effective. So you can find significant effects for direct mail or email pretty easily. Yeah,
absolutely. Man, there's so many things. And the bad news is we have to start to wrap up. But like, I've written down about 4 amazing quotes that I'm going to steal from you.
Yeah.
Like, randomization will set you free. I love that.
It will. It totally will.
This has been really awesome.
It's been utterly terrific. Yep. Couldn't agree.
What we really need to do is just find ways to like hang out on the side, you know, just to talk more. Because I've got lots more questions. Anyway, this is, I think, excellent and very helpful. There's so many more angles, but I think we've got to move on. One of the things we love to do on the show is called The Last Call. That's where we go around the horn and we just talk about something we've seen recently that we think is cool or neat or of use to our listeners. So you're our guest, Ellie. So would you like to go first?
Sure. I saw this tweet recently. This is related to what we've been talking about. I saw this tweet recently that I can't attribute because I can't find it again and I can't remember who gave it to me. So maybe it's the tweet that I dreamed. But when you find an interesting effect in your data or an interesting difference between two groups, the first thing you should ask yourself is, do I have enough data to say these are truly different? The second thing I should ask myself is it a fluke? And that was those two questions. I thought that was brilliant. Like, that's easy. No math. Just, do I have enough data to say that this is a real difference? And is it a fluke?
Nice.
See, there are cases for why more than 140 characters actually works out, because there's no way that fit all in.
This is the tweet I dreamed. So maybe the tweets I dream are verbose.
You should just tweet it. Get it out there. We'll retweet
it. You're listening and you're the person who gave that tweet, you know, tweet at me at Ellie Feit, E-L-E-A-F-E-I-T, so that I know who you are.
All right, Mo, what about you? You have a last call?
I do. I don't know if anyone's ever mentioned it before because it's not like super recent, but a while back we were at Super Week and Charles Farina from Analytics Pro did a presentation and he talked through some integrations and I ended up tweeting him, long story short, he talked through how to set up a tool called SessionCam. But the truth is, and that's a fantastic article, it's on his blog and we'll share that. But it's also just for him as a person, he's kind of inspired me to have a little bit of a tink around with some other GA integrations. So I set up another tool on Friday on Pet Project Day. So a shout out to Charles for getting me off, kicking me off my backside. And
Funky yeah. Charles Farina. That's going to make it a thing.
Everybody, Funky Charles Farina. All right. Tim, do you want to go or do you want me to go?
Why don't you go?
So I want to make a comment, though, because I think one of the things I felt like I heard or observed in you describing the difference between sort of classical statistics and Bayesian is this almost a sense of application that comes from Bayesian because you're considering sort of this concept of asymmetric loss and other things like that. And that's one of the things that I've been really trying as my team is developing. I'm trying to give them tools for application. And because like your students in the data science, they're super smart, have all these abilities to build predictive models on the data, but don't know the marketing application or context sometimes. So my first is probably a repeat of something I've said on the show before, but I'm starting with the beginning, which is Scientific Advertising by Claude Hopkins as what I'm having people read to get started on that. So that's my first last call. And then my second one is personal, which is there was a really great article recently by, I believe this woman was one of the founders of Ion Interactive, Anna Tallarico. And she wrote this article about how she lost her ability to do deep work and what she was doing to regain it because she was the CEO. And so she was spread so thin and doing things that I really kind of resonated with me because I feel like I go through that exact same thing. And then struggle to actually like engage deeply to do things like analysis or any kind of meaningful, real deep thinking. So really good article. So that's my other one. Okay, Tim, what have you got?
So I'm going to give a listener comment and then I'm going to tie into last call. So a guy I know, we were going back and forth on LinkedIn and his comment was, he was like, so whenever I listen to the podcast, I always feel like my scope of work is super small. Machine learning, AI, text mining. I'm trying to explain why customers hate my promo or why Adobe should never be allowed to touch our implementation. So he's having some challenges with his Adobe implementation. He also had earlier told me that I sounded like I was drunk on the Super Week episode. So, and so we were going back and forth a little bit about, hey, what if we are still in the world of giving my reports, be a data retriever, make recommendations, tell me what the campaign, how do we actually break out of it? And recently, because I recently took a new job, happens to be a company that pushes for a lot of kind of ongoing learning. So the very, very tactical free Code Academy subscription for learning Python, as I've been down the R path and I've had various reasons that I need to kind of ramp up on Python. And I just, Code Academy, which I've dabbled with in the past, but I was just struck by how well they make these little bite-sized things that you could literally carve off 20 minutes every morning for, you know, 2 weeks and go from zero to some basic level of understanding with something like Python or Git or, you know, whatever you want. Not directly applicable to digital analytics. It doesn't cover some of the challenges, you know, we have of how do we actually work with our data, but it's a fun little course to go through.
All right. I didn't know we were allowed to have two last calls.
Oh yeah, totally.
So I have another last call.
Get back in there. Absolutely.
So this is an old trick I learned in market research at General Motors. Before we were allowed to undertake any market research project or any kind of analysis project, and I think this applies broadly to all analysis projects that we might take on, try to get the decision maker to give you a decision criteria, which is sort of an if this, then that statement about how your analysis relates to what they're going to do. So get them to say something like, if you find out that this, well, in our case with cars, it was, if I find out that this car has a styling appeal level below 50%, I will redesign the car. or some other major investment that they're going to take on the basis of this, so that you get it immediately gets rid of the nice to know stuff and right down to the nitty gritty of if it's like if this then that.
I am a huge fan of the, you know, I believe this is going on. Like, don't just state your hypothesis. If your hypothesis holds up, then what action are you going to take? Because it's a way to validate that there's some actionability there. But I like the if this, then that.
At GM, we actually put it, we would record the statement and put it as the first slide in every report out deck we made for that decision maker.
Like you.
Wasn't a prom. They didn't. We didn't hold them to it, but we reminded them that they made. They told us that when we started.
That's fantastic.
Okay, you've been listening to the show, and you have a lot of questions and ideas and things that you want to ask Dr. Ellie McDonald Fight. So you should, and we would love to hear from you. And the way that you should reach out to us is via Twitter or our Facebook page or the Measure Slack. Are you on the Measure Slack?
Not yet. I'm not a digital analytics person, really.
Oh, we're going to make you one.
No, this is good because actually I think, A, your students will find this a useful group. And I think you can also give assignments to the people in Measure Slack when you want opinions. So this may be a community that you find useful.
Yes.
Okay.
Certainly we do. But anyways, those are the ways. But on Twitter, you can reach out to Dr. Fight at LE Fight. But we would love to hear from you. One thing for everyone out there, thank you so much. We've been asking over the past few episodes for more ratings and reviews on iTunes. We're not sure why we need those. But thank you for your response in giving those. I happened across our iTunes page and I saw those. And it's frankly, it's really heartwarming. Thank you so much for those ratings and reviews. Keep them coming. Okay. We would love to hear from you. Reach out to us in those ways. Dr. Fight, thank you so much for being on the show. This is amazing. We always say this and we really mean it this time, which is, my goodness, how we barely scratched the surface of what we wanted to talk about. Also, I really hope we were recording at the very beginning when I described how the show would go, because it almost kind of did, didn't it? And, and on that note, and for my two co-hosts, Mo and Tim, all of you out there, start being uncertain, but keep analyzing.
Thanks for listening, and don't forget to join the conversation on Facebook, Twitter, or Measure Slack group. We welcome your comments and questions. Visit us on the web at analyticshour.io, facebook.com/analyticshour, or at Analytics Hour on Twitter.
So smart guys wanted to fit in, so they made up a term called analytics. Analytics don't work.
The show will go like this. I'll get us kicked off, ask you the kind of that first question. We'll just get into a conversation at that point. Then you and Tim will just talk for about 45 minutes until I interrupt. That's not a you thing. That's a Tim thing.
Tim, are you freaking out that I'm talking about stuff before the show?
That's what you do, bro. What you do.
Bayesian statistics. Statistician,
nailed it.
Statistician, getting there. It's been an afternoon of heavy drinking.
Yay! Why are you so excited?
Me too. I'm like, how do we get you somewhere to a bar where we can just sit around and have a few drinks and keep chatting?
I live in Philadelphia, so yeah, if you're ever in a bar in Philadelphia, just call me and I'll come there. Where are we?
Okay, wait, I've got one more question now that the show
she's serious.
Yes, I'm deadly serious.
Rock flag and uncertainty.